Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm joined by a prolific author, artist, director, teacher, and animation writer. She's animated characters for Disney and Warner Brothers, and her books include Animated Performance and Prepare to Board. This will be part one of a two-part conversation. Part two will air on the next episode of the show. Nancy Beeman, it's a pleasure to have you on Words and Pictures.
Thank you for inviting me.
So Nancy, I want to ask you about your early days as an animator. Those were quite early days. In fact, you were making films back in high school.
Well, only because it was an assignment. I was not one of those people who was obsessed with animation from a very early age. And some of my classmates were. I only got really interested when I was about 16 years old. And that was considered fairly advanced age by my classmates. I can definitely recall my father bringing up the Preston Blair book when I was about 9 at a hardware store and saying, "Oh, look, I'll buy this for you. You already have a cartoon book. I'll get you this too." And I said, "I don't want to do those kinds of cartoons." Well, I lived to eat those words. And of course, that was the only real animation book available at the time. He bought it anyway. I didn't understand it. I got interested in it in high school, discovered I liked it, and was very lucky enough through a series of unlikely coincidences to get into the first class of the character animation program at CalArts. And so I went there.
These days, California Institute of the Arts is known as a training ground for Disney and other major studios. But back in the 70s, the character animation program was brand new.
It was brand new. And what happened was Jules Engel already had the experimental program. And what happened was the Disney studio had an unexpected success with a film called The Aristocats. They had planned to make it and then closed down the studio because Walt Disney had approved those boards and then died, and they would just make that film and shut it down. But suddenly it made a very big hit. Oh, we can continue making these things, but we need to train people. And they did have people coming in from Jules's program, but I guess they wanted to have more of a training thing the way they had in the 30s. So character animation was set up as a four-year program, and it was brand new. And I knew nothing about the school. Nobody did. But I knew, my parents and I both knew Disney. Oh, boy. So that's where I went out, never saw the place, never been out of the East Coast before. I had no idea what I was getting into. and realized when I got there that I needed to work very hard to catch up with the male students. And I worked very hard.
You're also a big believer in knowing about acting. And
we all are. I don't know anyone who isn't, unless they're doing effects animation. You can even make those act. So I don't know what the definition of acting is. In my case, I was writing down something that was going extinct, because I had seen this when working in studios and got more and more prevalent when I started teaching, that people start doing a video of themselves and then simply use that. And I have only used reference once in my entire career. That's when I had to animate a couple of scenes on Catterwall in Five Will Goes West, and that's John Cleese. And he's doing John's famous line, "What?" And I watched lots of Fawlty Towers until the tapes wore out, and I noticed that Cleese would raise his shoulder and shoot his head forward to the side. And so I went to Christophe Sarand, who was the supervisor on Catterwall, and I said, "I'm going to do this." And he said, "Catterwall does not have shoulders." I said, "Well, can I have a shoulder for this scene? May I run this by you?" And Christophe said, "All right." So in that scene, Catterwall has a shoulder. He shoots it up and he goes, "What? They love her. They adore her." So that's the only time I really studied acting footage. Otherwise, no, never.
Well, rotoscoping is an old animation technology. It's essentially tracing over reference footage. It actually lives on today in its digital counterpart in special effects.
Well, you have to understand rotoscoping is essential for special effects. If you shot live action and you have to turn the actor into a monster, it's essential to know where the muscles in the face are. And also, it is a very good tool when you have to do something that is absolutely realistic. Although I do know animators who can do it without roto. Roto is best, I think, when it's used creatively After all, Art Babbitt animated the Queen in Snow White, and there was live action shot for that. So you use them as a reference. You can't use them as a crutch. And I do not care for the school of Roto where it's just slap some paint on live action and call it animation. And I like it when it's basically not used much at all in what's supposed to be an anime, but it's essential for your visual effects films.
You always had a great feel for anatomy and pose and expression. The late 70s were thought of as a low point for American animation, but you started out then and you had, well, you led a bit of a charmed existence thanks to your talent being recognized early on.
That's very sweet of you, but we were all aware that we were dinosaurs. In fact, people told us, well, you're idiots. You're going into a profession. Everything's going to be done by computers by 1980. You're an idiot. Now, my parents were not the people saying this. Is other people who seem to know things. And we had several breaths of fresh air in the 70s. Of course, we saw the Disney films that were released then. We even had previews of things like The Rescuers. Milt Kahl came to visit our campus. But there was Dick Williams' titles to Return of the Pink Panther, which were stunning. That beautiful animation by Ken Harris. There was, again, from Williams, The Christmas Carol. Absolutely the best version I've seen of that story. Absolutely incredible animation. But there were some very exciting things done in the 70s. It's just that American animation, the death of the theatrical short happened then. The very last theatrical short I ever saw was done by John and Faith Hubley. It was called Cockabooty, and it played with Paper Moon. So get the date for Paper Moon. That's like 1973. And I remember that short brought the house down. The theater was in hysterics. But that is the last time I saw a theatrical motion picture, animated short. So that is the major reason why American animation slumps in that period. It's less of it. Disney is basically all that's left in theater. Hanna-Barbera never could seem to break into theatrical. They did try, but I remember not seeing them, to tell you the truth.
You know, I mentioned that you've worked for both Disney and Warner Brothers, but before that, your big break came along when you walked into a commercial animation studio in New York.
Yes, that was Jack Zander. And Jack said to me after he was raving about my work, says, yo, miss, he looks out sidelong, goes, you know, you really ought to try Disney. Like he wasn't really wanting to recommend it. And I said, well, they won't take me, sir. Why the hell not? Well, they didn't like my story. The hell with your story. It's great. Jack said to me later, Disney thinks they invented everything and own it all. And MGM really was Disney's equal in the late 30s in animation and design styles. Look at some of the harmonizing cartoons made at that time. And there's some stunning work in there. Disney even farmed out one of his silly symphonies to them. But they never went into features, obviously. And the Disney studio was animated features for so many years. I can understand why it took so long to get a category for animated features at the Academy. You can't just give it to the same studio every year. There has to be some competition. They had to wait till there were enough films made that would make it competitive. Now, I have maintained that there should be a best animated foreign film as well as domestic, just as there is with live action film, because it isn't fair to a really top-notch little studio that may not have the budget, but does have an artistically superior product to constantly lose to the big American studios. I'm not going to mention names of any of them, but we sort of know who they are. It's only fair to do what live action is doing. Let the foreign films have their own category. There are enough of them made to make this possible.
And it's often overseas from places like France and Japan where you see the traditionally drawn animated features these days.
Don't forget Ireland.
And Ireland,
Cartoon Saloon doing some blended. They use Maya as well as the hand-drawn. That's gorgeous.
Major American studios are still stuck on computer-generated imagery.
That's only because the producers will not back the others. As Bill Plimpton could tell you, there are other films being made. Signe Bauman also made her own film, a feature film called My Love Affair with Marriage. And you have also in the very independent of Nina Paley, who's made
yes.
Two feature films single-handed on a laptop. I mean, stuff. I used to joke that you could make a feature film in your closet by the year 2000. That was when computers were just starting to come in. I was off by a couple of years, but it is possible to do. And with the internet, you no longer have to worry about distribution. So there is actually more opportunity for independent animation now than there was 30 or 40 years ago. However, there's also a lot more to compete with. There's so much stuff out there. I don't know how people stand out above the crowd, but somehow they manage to do it. So there is a lot of independent production. There are a lot of them are hand-drawn. But what I am seeing, and I could not believe this, is that hand-drawn animation is becoming more popular in gaming. And I just spoke with one of my former students, Tina Novrotsky. Tina was one of the designers on Cuphead. And when she brought some animation over here, this was back around 2018, and showed it to me and said, we're doing this on paper and our background painter's painting wet and wet. I said, what century am I in? Every character in Cuphead was hand-drawn. That was news to me. So that's the gameplay as well as the cinematics, everything.
That's impressive.
Yeah, they were going to use cells, I was told, but they couldn't get them. I said, that's crazy. You don't do that. So they made the cell drop artificially in After Effects, and they even put cell dirt all over the film. But that's hand-drawn animation. It's an interesting new development. You find a new medium and you go into it. But the big features that cost millions that were hand-drawn, those are gone. And people have to get their heads around that. But there's no reason why you can't make an inexpensive one. Well, the game is very successful because it's a good game, but they're now doing other games with hand-drawn. So that is a totally new outlet. There's great interest in doing more hand-drawn animation. I don't know if it's going to be in that wild Rubber Hose 30 style. I've always wanted to do that style as well, and I only did it once. I animated the Dr. Seuss characters for commercials, the Cat in the Hat, or somebody being chased by a dog and having the legs going like windmills because there's no bones with Rubber Hose. I've always wanted to do something fun like that. You know, you can do both if you're trained in the Disney style. You learn different styles of animation and can adapt. And I was pretty well known for that. But I really enjoyed doing the Rubber Hose character.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking with author, artist, and animation writer Nancy Beeman. She's animated characters for Disney and Warner Brothers, and her books include Animated Performance, and Prepare to Board. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. There are all kinds of ways to join KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Nancy Beeman. So you're reluctant to call yourself an animation historian, but you were a young animator in the late 70s and early 80s, and you found yourself working with people who had been around since the 1930s, and you really paid close attention.
Well, we all did. There was an attitude then. First of all, there were some other young people working in the East, but in all the studios when we were coming in from CalArts, we knew we were coming up and having to learn things. So the attitude was to learn from the other people. And I think a good combination is having a more experienced person working with a younger person. The younger person will want to try something different. The older person can tell them if it's been done before, and it might also prompt them to try something. But age really has nothing to do with it. Hi Pindle was doing wonderful things in his 80s, and he was far more out there than 80% of his students. He was doing crazy, wonderful cartoons Since his passing, I've been able to see his panel cartoons and his drawings he did all the way back to childhood, because I know I'm friendly with his wife, and I'm just blown away by his incredible creativity throughout his life. Borger Ring's another one.
Well, I wanted to circle back to your student days, and you mentioned Zander's Animation Parlor. You were still at CalArts, and you came home for a holiday break to New Jersey, and you decided to visit this commercial animation studio in New York, and you're sort of shunted aside at first when you first came in the door. And there's a great quote that Jack Zander said about you later. He said, "You were 21 years old, you looked 14, you animated like a 50-year-old man, and no one had ever heard of CalArts. But you came in with a 16-millimeter reel, and you wowed them enough that they made you stay in New York for a week and help them animate a commercial."
Well, he offered me the week, and as luck would have it, I needed just that amount of money to pay off my car. So I accepted. I had the time, and I was still able to spend time with my family for Christmas break. And Jack was known as the Disney of the East. He had a top flight studio, and a lot of that was due to his studio reel looked like no other, mainly because he had Dean Yeagle as a staff designer. And Jack also really appreciated the full character animation because he'd been the original animator of Jerry Mouse in the first 6 Tom and Jerry cartoons.
Yeah, you said that his original studio before Zander's Animation Parlor was called Pelican Films. And this was in the 50s, 1950s, during the anti-communist Red Scare. And the studio became a front for artists and writers who were blacklisted from the big Hollywood studios. The reason was commercials had no credits.
Correct.
So artists banned from theatrical films could work safely there in New York.
Well, John Hubley went to New York for that reason and opened a commercial house. And Seamus Culhane and Jack Zander's studio are mentioned in a history of the Red Scare as being the major fronts. Well, they hired people from California who came east and didn't get credited on commercials because nobody did. So Selby Kelly, Walt Kelly's wife, told me it was a really terrible time, that it was unsafe for the union organizer to even sleep in their own beds. They had to sleep on the floor because people would be firing shotguns through the windows. It was a nasty time. And all the people I know who lived through it, including my parents, told me it was bad. My father had to take a loyalty oath before he could teach high school. And my mother said that people were too frightened to sign a petition about the quality of the food in the high school cafeteria because they might be considered communist. Now, I don't think I'd like to see those times come back again. All it takes is a fear of the other, fear of what you don't know, artistically as well as socially, and I won't get into social. But artistically, you watch films, and it's about what's on the screen, and it has different viewpoints from different cultures, and that is a good way to learn about them. It's a marvelous way in animation of communicating without dialogue. I made friends with a Chinese animator when I went to Zagreb. I spoke no Mandarin, he spoke no English, but we liked each other's films. So it was from the Shanghai studio. His name is Hu Jingqing. And I got cards from him for years. And we could exchange Christmas cards or year cards, whatever we exchanged. But his film was gorgeous and he liked mine. We can communicate without language. That's what I like about animation. It's also potentially incredibly dangerous in the wrong hands, which is, I understand now why the House Un-American Activities Committee hauled up John Hubley the week he was nominated for an Oscar. I believe he was testifying, because they made wartime cartoons. Well, of course, they had to. But this is now considered suspicious. It's just terrible when these things change. So the film will never change. The film is going to be the same forever unless people censor. But if you get a hold of these old films, you see totally different relationships. You see different cultures, different historical elements. And sometimes the propaganda films have become very obvious. I taught with some propaganda films at RIT. I found some made by both sides in the Second World War. And I ran them all. I said, if you are offended, you may get up and leave the room. Nobody ever did. It's a history class. You understand it's history. And so when you're showing a film that might have been made 70 years ago as entertainment that has something that now is unfortunate, if you tell people in advance that it's there, there's usually no objection. you say, okay, they were not particularly enlightened. They did this silly thing. The rest of the cartoon is great. And that has never led to a problem when I've screened it, but that is, I'm not teaching anymore, so I don't know how things have changed in the last couple of years.
So you're saying context is really important, and in fact, it keeps us from erasing the history that we had of really terrible stereotypical imagery back in, you know, the last century.
Well, I can recommend a history book called That's Enough, Folks, which I don't know the author's name, but he's a Black historian, and he writes over half of the Warner cartoons made in the 30s can no longer be shown because they fell back on the obvious stereotypes when they had nothing else they wanted to do. So in a historical sense, they should probably only be in a museum if they still exist. They would never be shown again. Warner's, when they released some of their films on disc, had the guts to say, look, these are films are what they are. If we censor them, that's like admitting none of these things ever happened. And I thought that was very good of them to put that title on there, and you can still see the cartoons. And as far as the others, there are, of course, cultural things we don't get anymore in the old cartoons. And a good one, say Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, has references that are now so dated that we can't even identify some of them. But the films are funny in spite of that. It doesn't matter that you don't know that Doc was based on a radio comedian who was totally forgotten today. Actually, I found out who he was and found him. But he was at the time the film was made, he was the most popular and funniest dwarf. Audiences in the 30s would have laughed hardest at Doc. In Warner cartoons, there are all kinds of references that my dad had to explain to me, especially the wartime cartoons.
There were some interesting experiments coming out of Disney many years ago when they tried blending hand-drawn with computer-generated animation, and then they kind of gave up on that. I mean, one of the underrated films you worked on, it was called Treasure Planet.
In the case of Treasure Planet, it was obviously a very big budget picture, and I animated the first scene combining the CGI with the hand-drawn. This was Billy Bones picking up a sea chest, which was CGI. And he's saying, they're after me, chests, that scheming cyborg and his band of cutthroats. And I did the layout on that too. There were no backgrounds. So I blocked the scene that he's going to fall. He's going to grab his throat and fall. And the camera moves a little faster than Billy does, because you cannot have the camera and the character moving at the same speed, or else he'll just stay in the center of the frame. So did all that blocking, got it okayed by the directors, animated the scene. Bones was a tough character, and he's not typical assignment for me. He certainly wasn't funny. And I enjoyed working with Patrick McGoohan's voice, and I got to meet him twice. He's a remarkable man and did a very good performance. And I didn't believe this is the same guy who played the Scarecrow. Yeah. I saw him in a movie called The Three Lies of Thomasina when I was a child, and didn't realize that's the same man, that he'd done a lot of work for Disney. First thing he said when he met me is, I've seen you before. I said, but sir, I've never appeared in front of the camera. Now that I know he worked for Disney all those years, he probably had seen the documentary, The Making Of, on the Hercules disc where I do appear. So yeah, The Prisoner was amazing. He was an incredibly interesting person because he said he was more interested in writing than acting. So it's good to have more than one arrow in your quiver. And I've always been interested in story, because if you can do great animation, it helps to have a good story. Great animation will not save a bad story. And a less than superb animated scene will not destroy a really good film. Again, looking at the old Disney features, there are some scenes that aren't as well animated as others. They're different people, maybe different levels of skill, but they're greater than the sum of their parts. That's what a good story, a good structure will do for you. There's more than one studio in the world. But at the time, if you wanted to do full character animation, you pretty much didn't have a choice. Warner's, I don't believe, was doing much. And a lot of people went to Hanna-Barbera. I was lucky to get to Xander's, not knowing he existed either, and do the full animation that I was taught to do.
And you did do some work for Warner Brothers.
Oh, Mo, quite a lot. I started working for Warner's through Greg Ford in the mid-80s, starting with storyboard. And then we subcontracted an entire sequence from a film called Quackbusters. I also animated a lot of the Warner TV specials, most of which can't be seen anymore. Pity, because I really enjoyed Bugs and Daffy's Video Wars, where they're running rival music video stations, and Greg put in these insanely old music clips from films as far back as 1931 and had them yelling like they're actual DJs over this. And I had a lot of fun animating Daffy. I mean, he's such a great character.
It's funny that that you ended up animating both Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny, because you say that you learned how to put on lipstick from watching Bugs Bunny cartoons as a kid.
That's absolutely true. And my kid sister, when I asked her for some tissue paper, she goes, "Nobody's used tissue paper since 1945. Why are you doing this?" And she's younger than me. She thought I was being a fool. It's true. I watched Bugs Bunny do it. And I guess that's how you do it. You put these great big lips on and you blot it with a tissue. And no one's done that. I saw my mother do it, I think, last around 1962. but I enjoyed Bugs Bunny, and he's the trickster rabbit. This is ridiculous about this whole nonsense about Bugs and drag. Of course he is. Bugs can be anything he wants to be. He can be a doctor. He can be a barber. He can be a world famous conductor. In one of the very funniest Bugs Bunny cartoons, the long hair hair. They go, "Leopold, Leopold," as he comes out with his ears in a snood. And my father, who was a classical musician, loved that cartoon. It would crack up every time that happened. And there's a joke that most people won't get. Bugs is handed a baton by a very frightened Klemperer. That's Otto Klemperer handing him the baton, and he takes it and breaks it in half. Leopold Stokowski did not conduct with batons. So only a musician would know that. So Dad would fall apart laughing and say, "Oh, Stokey never used a baton." So that's why that scene is in there.
And then, of course, Warner's did a parody of Fantasia.
Oh, many. There were three parodies of Fantasia. First is the Corny Concerto by Bob Clampett. What's Opera Doc is, of course, the most elaborate. And it's a wonderful cartoon, absolutely delightful cartoon. And it's intriguing to note that Warner's detested it, because Maurice Noble was doing really great things with color, like putting Elmer Fudd into magenta when he's angry. But they didn't understand that. It's a pity, because it's such a wonderful cartoon.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we've been bringing you part one of a two-part conversation with author, artist, director, teacher, and animation writer Nancy Beeman. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. And if anyone is interested in seeing the films or the books that I've been talking about, they're on my website, which is nancybeeman.com. Not difficult to find.
Can you spell that for the listeners?
It's nancybeeman.com. I also have, so far, five articles on the Animation World Network. It's called Animated Characters. So if you go to the Animation World Network, their magazine section or blog section, you should find Animated Characters there, and that will have the entire Art Babbitt interview in two parts, along with my Jack Zander stories and a very funny one about a body in a window seat, and an upcoming one will be about a very funny incident in a London studio, which was better than anything in our movie. So the film Short History of Indians in Canada is on that site, along with Your Feet's Too Big and two other films that I produced, which are not generally been shown.
Well, on that note, thanks again. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.